Good morning. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on a beautiful spring morning. The time is now just 1 minute before the top of the hour. That's 11 o'clock. Coming up next on The Boo on the Radio Zine, we speak with journalist Anne Newman about her new book, The Good Death, an exploration of dying in America. And later in the hour, we hear from Molly Worthen, an assistant professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, on the new law there that allows for discrimination against LGBT people. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. KBOO Community Radio has been broadcasting in Portland since 1968. Not only do we provide thought-provoking news, live performance, and excellent music, we provide broadcast training and access. We're asking you to help us celebrate KBOO by voting for us in Willamette Week's Best of Portland poll. Cast your vote during the nomination phase from now until March 31st, which is tomorrow. There are a few categories KBOO fits into, so write us in as often as you can. Also, don't forget to nominate your favorite shows and hosts as well. For more information, including a link to the poll online and category suggestions, go to kboo.fm/BOP2016. And now stay tuned for Radio Zine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pan-African film series hosted by the All African People's Revolutionary Party. The film this month is Assata Shakur Talks About Socialist Development in Cuba, showing Wednesday, March 30th at 6 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union in room 236. The former Black Panther and member of the Black Liberation Army, who has had political asylum in Cuba since 1984, talks about socialist practices in Cuba, racism, patriarchy, and the way forward for socialist politics. Again, that's Assata Shakur Talks About Socialist Development in Cuba, Wednesday, March 30th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union in room 236 at Portland State University, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What happens when Oz and Wonderland collide in a twisted brain of a mad composer? A freaking musical, of course. KBOO is proud to present Nick T. Devlin's new musical, Alice Trippin' Sixes. It's a strange and unusual music odyssey. Flying monkeys, scarecrows, jokers, and even midday tokers. Oh, this ain't your normal musical, man. It's a far-out psychedelic trip into the mind of the mad. This is going to be one wild and crazy musical event. Alice Trippin' Sixes, Thursday, March 31st at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. My guest is Anne Newman, author of the new book, The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America. She is a visiting scholar at the Center for Religion and Media at New York University, where she is a contributing editor to The Revealer. The Good Death examines how we in the U.S. approach death and how those of us close to dying loved ones live in death's wake. Anne Newman, thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Can you talk about your own personal experience that led you to explore this topic?
Yeah, I was in my late 30s, and my father had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma for about 10 years. And I kind of knew, because of that long lead time, that he was going to die. But I had no idea what the process was going to be like. And I think so much of our media tells us that it's this lovely process where someone lies down in bed and you give them soup and they tell you they love you and then they close their eyes. And that was not at all what went down. And so Dad ultimately crawled into bed, yes, but what came about then were 3 months of feces and puke and dirty bedclothes and the real visceral aspects of a dying body, its processes slowly shutting down. And on top of that, we had a whole host of relationship stuff that all family members do. And I was broadsided. Mm-hmm. I was broadsided by the grief that preceded his death, just the challenges of keeping him happy. And, you know, when someone's in pain, they're miserable, and all of that comes out, as well as the love and family members and all of that. But then after he died, it was the absence that was so profound for me. And I think we have, in many ways, professionalized the dying process and removed it from daily life. It is behind hospital curtains. It is taken care of by nurses and doctors. And so neither he nor I, nor my sister or our family members, knew what was going to happen. And that was incredibly disconcerting to me. So I sat with it for about a year and a half. And then I said, wait a minute, this is still with me. I'm still angry. I'm angry at my society and the hospice workers and my family and no one telling me what this meant, what this was going to be like. And then I did what good journalists do, and I started asking questions. I became a hospice volunteer, and I queried every person I could who was close to death and dying, anything from healthcare. And as you know, the book is kind of crazy ambitious, and the places that I go to answer the question, was his a good death? Is this how it happens? And why did I not know?
Yeah, I think that issue of not knowing what's going to happen on so many levels is key in the whole experience of dying as we experience it with others.
Yeah, and you know, it hasn't always been that way that we're removed. If you think about, 50 to 100 years ago, deaths took place in the family home. It was really in the 70s when we began to grossly institutionalize the dying process. So we've lost the craft. We don't know how to care for people, or we don't have the same family structures in many ways, thank God. But we don't have the same means of caring for those who are dying.
Right. You quit your job, right?
I had no choice. I mean, I guess there were other things we could have done. We probably could have paid a home health care worker. But again, I had no idea that it was going to take 3 months. I didn't know what to expect at all. And it just made the most sense. My sister had 2 children in diapers. And however coarse and gruff my father was, I don't think we could have gotten through it if I hadn't gone home.
Now, you mentioned there was this change in the 70s, and you mentioned that in the book, that death in America changed in the 70s. What happened to change things so much?
Yeah, wonderful things, right? These fantastic medical advancements where 911 lines became much more efficient. Ambulances could get to individuals on the street. We were also urbanizing at a quick rate. Or suburbanizing at a quick rate. And the medical advancements like respirators and defibrillators, the code blue that we know of, a way to restart the heart or to continue inflating the lungs long after those systems have naturally stopped. So the ability to resave, to restart these systems was enormous. And we now have the ability to save lives that we would have lost. So in that sense, it's wonderful. However, along with that, the definition of death was changed. So it used to mean the end of breathing and heart rate, and brain function would, you know, come along with that almost simultaneously. And then, with the ability to keep the heart and the lungs going, we were left with the brain. And even today, and I assume for quite a long time yet, the brain will continue to be a mystery. And what we don't understand, and what we see come out in cases like Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Cruz and Terry Schiavo in 2005 is, of course, this grappling with what is alive and what is dead. We have particular standards in medicine that tell us, but they're changing all the time. And when you think about this large question of what is alive and what is dead as a cultural construct, it's pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. So does alive mean you have just your brainstem, in which your eyes may still open? You will still have a sleeping cycle. You can open your mouth and have some physical motion, but for the most part, all your higher functions are gone. Or is it full brain death? The stem and everything else is no longer active. It has died. And we've seen a recent case in Oakland, not too far away, Oakland, California, where a child went through an extensive tonsillectomy and was brain dead. And her family is still keeping her on physiological support. She's still on a respirator and a feeding tube because they refuse to acknowledge that that small bit of brain stem function actually, she's got none. So they see that her heart is still beating, even if artificially. They think she's alive. So we're always going to reckon with these things. This came about in the 1970s. All of a sudden, the decision to remove physiological support, usually begun in a trauma situation, like Terry Schiavo, for instance, had collapsed on her floor. It took a long time for her husband to say, I get it now, she's not in there, and she wouldn't want to go on like this. It became a decision for him, and then ultimately an enormous court battle that raged across the country and went all the way to the president.
Do you have a sense of how our culture is approaching those kinds of situations? In a sense, it feels like it's different than when those particular cases, the two Schiavo and, well, the three, Schiavo, mm-hmm. Cruzan, and Quinlan, mm-hmm. They created so much publicity and everybody was aware of them, and it was kind of went on the news for weeks and weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, those issues are not so much in the fore. Do you feel that, or what's your feelings about that?
I think you know, the Quinlan case was in the 70s. Cruzan, I would have to double check, but I believe it was the 80s. And we're talking long periods of time that these individual and strangely young women were their life and well-being, their state was contested. Schiavo died in 2005. That was just a few months before my father died. So I feel as though it's not so long ago. The reason that it was so big in our consciousness, I think, has something to do with the contesting groups. You know, as soon as you bring in the Catholic Church, which claims such a great authority on our healthcare system, which still tries to dictate for us what our moral and ethic codes should be, and that, as we saw with the Affordable Care Act discussion, still has an enormous influence on our laws. As soon as those powers are brought to bear on individual cases, I think we do have these enormous issues. I mentioned Jahi McMath in Oakland, California. That was a big deal. It may not have had the precedent of Terry Schiavo, but Schiavo's family did a huge job. They recruited Operation Rescue. What's the abortion activist's name? I've lost it now. Randall Terry, right? Mm-hmm. And he's a media sensation. He knows how to make controversy. He organized protesters outside Schiavo's hospice, and they were able to get to, say, state representatives in Pennsylvania and other places. Ultimately, George Bush flew back to try and sign a new law. So it depends on the national pulse. I think there are a number of movements that have arisen over the past few decades to address this gross fear that we have of being, you know, I was going to say kept alive, but being kept on machines, maybe not alive. And so we've seen, say, the movement to make more effective end-of-life documents like medical proxies or advanced directives. We've seen the aid in dying movement, which I think has done a fantastic job, both in this state and the other states where it's legal, to really talk about what's taking place. Why is the dying process so elongated now? It takes so much longer to die because we have the medical means to prop up one failing system after another. And, you know, we've assumed for a few decades that that's the way to die, you know, fighting and kicking. But I think the aid in dying movement is saying, wait a minute, this is not fun. This is not good. And medicine isn't always benign or helpful. Sometimes it can be torture. So a number of movements have come out of those cases that I think are incredibly effective. Hospice use is higher in states where aid in dying is legal, for instance.
And hospice, let's talk about hospice for a minute. How has it changed things, do you think?
Yeah, I was just talking about all the medical advancements that came about in the 70s. And hospice, too, came out of that period in time, roughly 74. The first hospice was founded in the United States. And the overarching ethos of hospice is brilliant. Like, let's take people out of this barrage of curative treatment, quote unquote, curative treatment, and let them stay at home. Let them be comfortable and have their family around them. And that's a fantastic premise. I think where hospice fails in many ways, and I'll say hands down, I'm a huge fan of hospice. I'm a volunteer, and I have been for a long time, and I will continue to be. But I do think that there are some problems with hospice. The program, because of Medicare requirements, will cover the last 6 months of life, but the median stay at the moment is 7 days. Which means we're not fully utilizing the program. In some cases, we see that patients hesitate to go in because they don't want to stop curative treatment, or they feel pushed by their family to keep fighting, whatever that means. I also think that there's a philosophy to hospice that doesn't work for everyone. Some people don't need to crawl into bed and reckon with their regrets. And hospice is wrangling with all of those great ethical questions that the rest of us are. I have a dear family friend who is caring for her grandmother. She and her mother are caring for their grandmother, and the hospice nurses want to spoon feed this beautiful but now very demented, physically disabled, dying woman. And the family say, this is torture. This is not necessary. It's not what she would have wanted. Why must we syringe or try to spoon feed her? We need to accept that she's dying. So there are pushbacks. And as hospice, like any other local program, it's made up of people in the grassroots level. Mm-hmm. And so they come to death and dying with their own concerns and religious understandings. And it's not always easy to match up healthcare workers or hospice workers and the needs of a family.
And some people go in and out of hospice. I mean, they are in it and then their life is extended and they are no longer in it.
Yeah, I just had a hospice patient who lived for 4 years. So the hospice program, as it's established, again, through Medicare, a patient must be recertified every 6 months. And I don't really have a problem with that. I think if someone is given a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live by a doctor, or two in some cases, their needs are great. I know that the hospice program has received a lot of criticism, particularly for-profit hospices, for taking in patients and having to recertify them. They live longer than anticipated. And my feeling is that that's really just addressing a huge hole in our healthcare system. If you aren't yet terminal, if your doctor can't say you've got 6 months or less to live, you still have care needs that are not being addressed. And so this bouncing in and out of hospice is cute. It's hugely traumatic. In some cases, there are hospital visits, ER room visits. They're in that. It's terrible for a family. And if it were up to me, if I could snap my fingers right now, Kathleen, and change it, we would extend the hospice duration. Because clearly, if 7 days is the mean, we shouldn't worry so much about the people who are in there more than 6 months.
Yeah, I know that in my own mother's case, the ability to declare that she was in hospice was such a, I don't know if gift's the right word, but it was such a problem solver because before that, her insurance coverage of a home nurse visits would end at a certain point after her hospitalization, right? It would only cover a certain number of weeks. And then once she decided she was not going back to the hospital, if they hadn't had the option of hospice and that allowing these visiting nurses to come, I don't know what we would have done.
Right. It's still not enough, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
If you don't have a home, let's say, if you don't have family members to cover, I know in New York, I think it's something like 4 hours a day is all that hospice can cover.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have someone to cover the other and you're incontinent and you are disabled, unable to move, what do you do for the other 20?
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's highlighting this, in many cases, disparity that so many of us encounter at the end of life. If you can afford a home health aide, in New York, the going rate is $13
wow.
cash under the table. And I mean, it varies in every state, I'm sure, because it's all informal. You know, if you can do that, it's not the best job, right? It's a really dirty, difficult job, and without any protections, any discussion of grief, any sick
right.
day leave, any of that, it can be grueling. However, if you're a family and you're paying $13 an hour, it adds up really quickly. So while we need to change the job environment for these care workers, we also have to have a larger conversation about how to get care workers in the home. We don't know how to pay for it now, and we're just, other words, you know, allowing people with money the best care possible. And this is no surprise, right? If you can afford good care, you get it. And if you can't, we look the other way.
And talking to organizers of caregivers, those people need much more support, both financially, they need benefits, they need a fair wage, they need time off, which
mm-hmm.
often they don't get.
Mm-hmm.
So from that angle, there are all these issues. And then from the, just as you said, the experience of the family, there are all these issues of how to pay for that.
Of course. You know, so many people want to die at home, 80%, and only about 20% do. So we know that we're getting it wrong. We just haven't figured out how to do so, how to address it. And there's a terrible inequality built into our healthcare systems. You know, the people on the lower rungs of our class ladder, socioeconomic class, it's often along racial lines and poverty questions come into play here. Those are the people that end up with poorer health, with fewer resources, often don't have their family around them. They haven't earned as much, so they don't have a retirement savings, because basically retirement at this moment we leave up to personal responsibility, which is a hideous phrase when we're talking about healthcare. And we're leaving these people high and dry. And those who need it the most have less chance of getting it.
I'm speaking with Anne Newman. We're talking about her book, The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America. This is KBOO Radio Zine. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. As you mentioned earlier, you traveled for this. You interviewed people, you spent time in various situations, including hospice, volunteer work, which you still do.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about some of the people that were important in the book. One, for instance, is a Montana man named Robert Baxter. Can you talk about the significance of his work?
Robert Baxter, in my mind, was incredibly brave. He had a number of illnesses that stacked up over time. He wasn't particularly old, but he was very determined that he did not want to die a long, slow death. And so he contacted Compassion and Choices, which is the nation's largest end-of-life organization and strong proponents of the death with dignity bills that were passed here in Oregon and in Washington. So Baxter got together with them and brought a case against the Supreme Court in Montana. And he died before the Supreme Court case was argued. He died before the decision came out. But on the basis of that case, aid in dying is now legal in Montana. So there are a number of ways that we see aid in dying become legal in states. Again, with Oregon and Washington, it was via ballot measure. In Vermont, it was via the legislature. And we just saw California legalize at the end of last year. In December, the governor signed it into law. And Montana is the only state where it was done via court case. However, there are at least two dozen states that have some form of legalization effort in process right now. In New York, for instance, there's both a court case as well as a legislative effort. But, you know, these legislative efforts have been taking place forever. I think California's successful attempt was number 5. So they had been pushing for it for a long time. I did not get to meet Robert Baxter. He died before I went there to do my research, but I spent some time with his daughter, whose name is Roberta King, and she's come out as a very vocal supporter of death with dignity laws. There's been a lot of pushback since passage in Montana. Because it was passed via the court, it doesn't have the same rigorous regulations surrounding it like the laws do in Oregon and Washington and elsewhere. And so I think opponents have tried to pull apart and pick at it, this court decision, in some way. Also, the Supreme Court wasn't really definitive. They basically said, there's nothing in the Constitution that says you can't have a doctor prescribe lethal medication. So, So maybe I should describe how death with dignity works in the states where it was passed with all these regulations. You have to make a request of your doctor, both verbally and in writing. There's a waiting period in between. In some cases, a second doctor must also approve your request. If there's any question about your mental competence, you have to see a shrink. And, if it's proven that you are mentally competent, then a doctor is able to prescribe a lethal dose of medication to you that you then pick up at the pharmacy and take home and decide to use or not use at your own discretion. So it's very strict. There's an elaborate reporting mechanism that accompanies it, which is great. Right now we've got 17 years of data out of Oregon. And the ability for patients to keep it in the drawer was kind of a way to alleviate their fear of pain, has proven to be incredibly helpful. But let's say you do have dementia or some neuromuscular disease where from one day to the next, you don't know what your competence, whether mental or physical, will be. And so this death with dignity law works for many and does not work for many.
Yeah, I think just taking many medications makes your mental state, you don't know what it's going to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I could tell you all the cases I hear on a regular basis of someone finding that their mother or grandmother is falling or not eating or deeply confused, and then they talk to the doctor or they check her medications, and she's got like 4 doctors and 10 medications and half of them conflict. And so just getting elders off medication can be a huge improvement, but you're absolutely right. It's it can confuse a patient, and they will lose their ability to make use of aid in dying.
Another person that I was surprised to read about in the book, I just wouldn't have thought that you would go into the area of someone in prison who was a hunger striker. How did that have relevance to your topic?
Because Terry Schiavo, the case was so prominent during my father's death, it stuck with me. And so I was doing some elaborate research on her case, and I started to ask myself, where else in the U.S. can a person be fed against their will? So the courts ultimately decided that Schiavo was on a feeding tube, which would have been against her will, and the tube was removed, and she died 13 days later. So where else in the country, I asked, could a person be fed against their will? And of course, the first place you look is prison, right? As I did. And I tracked down Bill Coleman, who became a good friend. We still communicate on a regular basis. But at the time, our communication was very difficult. He had brought a case against the state of Connecticut saying, I am on hunger strike. It is an exercise of my First Amendment rights. And you know, the courts have allowed this prison warden to come in and shove a rubber tube up my nose, down my throat, and into my stomach, and fill it with Ensure, that nutrient drink, whenever they feel like it. This is a gross violation of my rights. So his case was unsuccessful, and I realized, holy, this is not just something that's this is not an anomaly. This is not something that takes place on, say, foreign soil like Guantanamo. Hunger striking prisoners in the United States are force-fed all the time. And they are done so with court order. the local judge who knows the warden says, yeah, sure. And I think so much of this comparison of the Schiavo case and of Bill Coleman's case allowed me to think more deeply about the ethics of medicine and the ethics of informed consent, the ethics of bodily autonomy, but also then larger issues of, say, pain and how we use it or value it in society. You know, women's pain, we know from studies, is not recognized by doctors in the same way that men's is. And certainly prisoners' pain isn't. We see prisoners as deserving of pain, or they wouldn't be inside, we say. Mm-hmm. So I think the warden at Bill's prison really thought that he should be suffering. But they also then could play this kind of benevolent force where we don't want him to die. We're going to save his life. And you can see that kind of paternalism that is so rampant within our incarceration system applied to Bill, that they would strap him down and force this tube up his nose and feel like they were in the right. It was chilling. Mm. And so ultimately, Bill lost his case, served out his term, and then was deported to the UK, where he's from.
And survives.
I was in touch with him not long after, like a day after his deportation. And I said, what's the first thing you ate, Bill? And again, first thing he ate in like 6 years that wasn't liquid, like shoved down his throat, or water that he took himself. It was a dry piece of toast. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Anne Newman. The title of her book is A Good Death. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU. Then to get into another area that I wasn't thinking of when I first started the book, the whole area of disability activism. And, well, there's one group called Not Dead Yet. There's an activist that you did develop a relationship with, Bill Peace.
Yeah. Bill's pretty incredible. He's paralyzed from the waist down, roughly the waist down, since the age of 16 from a rare disease that disabled him. And he's gone on, from a large Catholic family, he's gone on to get a PhD. He's older than I am, but the reason I met him is because we had this enormous online spat that lasted a number of days with a lot of disability rights individuals weighing in and me kind of almost blindly fumbling to understand their very staunch anti-aid in dying position. And what was confusing to me is that they were using a lot of the same language and rhetoric that we hear from pro-life groups, again, quote-unquote pro-life groups. And I was flummoxed because in my mind, disability rights meant autonomy. It meant a disabled person saying, wait a minute, I deserve a job. I deserve access to this building. I deserve full education. I am not lesser than anyone else. So I thought that autonomy would be the objective of this group. Well, after at least three days of online feuding, Bill sent me a message and said, you know, if you want to get lunch sometime, let's go. And I drove up to where he was a couple hours north of the city, and we got on like a house fire. He's a super person and really smart. And what he made me see, and what my relationship with him has taught me, is that the fear he has of medicine and of society is real. I don't agree with him that aid in dying translates into kind of taking out the most vulnerable. And again, from 17 years of statistics and data from Oregon and data from other states where aid in dying is legal, we know it's just not true that the death with dignity law does not lead to abuse or preying upon vulnerable individuals. But the fear is very real to Bill, and that's a result of a medical system that has again and again taught him that he's not like the rest of us. It's from a society that doesn't really require curb cuts so his chair can go from sidewalk to street. From his experience of being invited to speak at a disability rights event and finding that it's on the third floor of a building without an elevator. I mean, Bill's experience can't be discounted simply because we disagree with him. And so the lesson that came out of my relationship with him, and I'm not sure if he's read the book yet. I know he has a copy and all of that. And I do basically say, I love this person and I think he's wonderful and I support him in any way I can. But he's, in my mind, in my opinion, according to the data, wrong about the way these laws work. That doesn't mean that we have a long, long way to go, 25 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act, to actually bring disabled individuals into our community.
Mm-hmm.
We've failed, and we need to keep trying.
And he is saying, or people in the movement, the Not Dead Yet group, are saying that these people who are choosing death in, say, the Oregon, under the Oregon statute, mm-hmm. that they have a disability, and so that there's equating a preying on people because, you know, they are disabled at that point and making this decision.
Right. I mean, ultimately, if we want to take that definition of disabled and think of it very broadly, we will all be disabled, every one of us. And sometimes it's temporary, a pregnancy or a broken foot. And sometimes it's permanent and increasing, like any of our elders who need a walker or lose their eyesight. So we think of disability as very narrow, and yet it's something that will affect all of us. And I believe that's a really beautiful way for us to think about disability. But the laws for death with dignity only apply to terminal patients. That means you've got 6 months or less to live. Bill would quibble with me saying that. He would say, well, what does a doctor know? Even you have a patient who's lived 4 years in hospice. And he's right. But if you're not actively dying, you're just not able to use the law. And doctors pretty much do know when you're actively dying. But again, it's not up to the doctor. It's up to the patient. And that's the autonomy issue.
So we've covered a lot of the issues. There are a lot of issues covered in this book. But one question that I had for you is, after doing all this research, after thinking about this subject so extensively, what do you think a good death is?
Yeah, it's the title of the book, right? The Good Death. And I don't have a definitive answer. I have to say it is whatever a patient wants within realistic terms, right? Within the realm of reality. And the best we can get is a good enough death. It's always going to hurt those around us, or it's the end. It's the ultimate end, and so there has to be some grief about that. I don't know if we'll ever have the good death, but we can get a lot closer than we are now. Good enough is a good goal, and we have a long way to go.
And what we think of as the good death might not be exactly what we had in our mind. I mean, it might involve all kind of other things that we didn't realize came along with it.
Right. Well, my dad's idea of a good death was going home and crawling into bed, and he didn't know that it wasn't going to be that simple. He didn't know that it was going to take as long or be as painful and visceral as it was. And so if we knew more about the dying process, we could make better decisions about what we want for ourselves. But we don't all want the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with hospice. That's the problem with, even, say, Buddhist hospice programs that have a particular understanding of the steps that a dying patient needs to go through to find peace. I think we're all very different, and we need to determine that for ourselves.
And is there anything that you think of as activism, as good activism around this issue?
Yeah. We're hearing a lot more about death and dying, as we must. We have a huge crisis facing us. An enormous number of seniors are making up a larger part of the population. We don't have the resources at all. We don't have enough gerontologists. We don't have this solution to home health care. nuclear families don't exist anymore. We still think of caretaking as primarily women's work. And so we don't value it in the same way. We have so many problems to face. We have to talk about it now. But my feeling, and I guess my own advocacy position, is that the conversation's not enough. You can talk to your doctor. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, he'll even get paid if you do. But you have to initiate that yourself. And that is that conversation is only going to take place among those who have the resources already. There are so many people in the country that need to be brought into our healthcare system. There are so many systemic changes that we need to make to reduce disparity in how we provide care. And so the conversation is not enough, unless you're talking to your legislator. Go give them a call, send them an email, and say, we need to talk about end-of-life care.
I want to thank you very much for being here at KBOO and talking about this very interesting subject. Thank you, Ann Newman.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Ann Newman. The title of the book we've been talking about is The Good Death, subtitle, An Exploration of Dying in America. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. If you want to hear this interview again, or if you missed part of it, it will be available later today on our website, kboo.fm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Molly Worthen, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Molly Worthen.
Thanks for having me.
And Molly, I'm trying to get an understanding of North Carolina's legislature and governor's obsession with public toilets and bathrooms in general. The Attorney General of North Carolina said that North Carolina's new law limiting LGBT protections is a national embarrassment. I mean, do they honestly believe that if you walk into a public toilet straight, you come out gay?
Well, of course not. But the question of public bathrooms is highly symbolic and very charged, and it touches on a